After Talk, an exclusive Dr. Jane Ruby show feature. I'm here after taping a great show with war correspondent and analyst Michael Yan. Michael, thank you so much for staying over. I wanted to, there was so much that we talked about and that you shared, and it certainly paints a doom and gloom picture of what's, because this is a global takedown. We know that because everything was in lockstep with the COVID pandemic, fake pandemic, which everything was in, everything is in lockstep right now. We ended the show. You gave us a great foundational piece on the Nord Stream pipeline, what this means. This is like death by a thousand, not cuts, but gouges. They're actually pretty big. The pipeline, the burning of our fields and destruction of food manufacturing plants. These are all, this is all part of the plan. And I want you to share a little bit more if you want to on how you see that. But I also want to know, what do you think about when you think about overcoming this? Because I know you have hope for the future, full disclosure. We share some mutual friends. We spend some time together. I know you're hopeful. I know you think there is a pathway to survive as some kind of a nation, as Americans and the world. We have world partners and fellow humans that are suffering as well. What are your thoughts on that? I'm not asking you to paint a rosy picture, but what are you thinking? And you're global, but how does the average person maybe relate to, well, what can they do besides support you and Ann Vandersteel in Operation Burning Edge?
Well, first of all, they have to recognize that things are going to change, period. And that's such a safe prediction. I've never made a safer prediction other than saying, if I drop this pen, it'll fall to the floor.
Right.
You know, I mean, things are going to change and dramatically. And if we continue with the government that we have, you will be destroyed, period. Because this government is captured. It's openly, look at Biden in his last speech. You know, of course, he's not the president. He's just sausage stuffed into that suit.
Right.
And so he's a meat puppet. He's what's called a dog king in information war.
So what's above him? Who's pulling, in your opinion, from your perspective?
That'll be some globalist oligarchical structures, clearly. Who the specific people are, I don't know. A lot of people will say, you know, Biden or whatever, or not Biden, but Obama, that clown. Right. I went to a school twice in Indonesia, by the way. That kid came from a rich upbringing, Obama. But Obama is not the big mastermind. Obama is a little piece of fruit off the tree. He might think he's the big dog, but the moment he steps out of line, they'll smoke him too, right?
Right.
I mean, he's not all that. He just stays in lockstep. He's got the right color and that sort of thing. And he was brought up as what's called a red diaper baby. A red diaper baby is a term that's not used much anymore, but it means your parents were members of the American Communist Party. Ah. Not that his were members of the American Communist Party, but they were communists, right? Mm-hmm. But I went to a school in Indonesia, and I went to a school in Jakarta. I went there twice. He grew up rich. I mean,
wow.
You know, he did. You should see that place. Look at it on Google Earth. I went into the school twice. When I was there at a counterterrorism course one time, and I said, oh, let's go over it. I went over there with Al Johnson. We looked at it. And that's just like, so this is the poor boy school. It's nicer than 99% of Americans will ever see. But the bottom line is he is not a mastermind. He is a fruit off of a tree in a very large orchard that was planted before we were born, right? Mm-hmm. There's nobody alive watching this who was alive when this started. It all predates us.
Good point.
We were born into an orchard that was already there, right?
Yes.
And there were people warning us about it. You can look at old black and white films, people are warning us about it. You know, or you can hear Paul Harvey warning, what if I were the devil, right? I mean, listen to that one.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy is right on target.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a lot of, even if you look at old Reagan stuff from the 1950s, when it's all black and white, you know, and it just pick a dozen random thing of films, you know, where Reagan's giving speeches back in the 50s. I mean, that guy is right on target.
Yeah.
And word for word, it's come true, like in bizarre ways. You know, I spent a lot of time in communist country. I grew up in Florida, and people would, you know, talk about how bad communists were. I thought they were exaggerating, you know what I mean? Because I'd never been to a communist country. And then I went up, next thing you know, I'm spending a lot of time in communist countries like East Germany, Czechoslovakia, I went to check Romania, Poland, you know, and many others. And so the bottom line is I went back to Winter Haven, Florida, where I'm from. And I went back to that church, First Nazarene Church. And I was like, let me tell you what, let me give you an update. It's a lot worse than you ever said.
Ooh.
I mean, it's a lot worse.
Yeah.
You know, I became like wildly anti-communist.
I've observed you as a great student of history, the history of wars, what makes them, the history of what you're talking about. And, you know, that's, at first I thought, well, wow, why is he so interested in that? Now I see the way you tie it together and you confirm that this is, like you said, we stepped into an orchard that was planted long ago. In fact, legal analyst Catherine Watt from Pennsylvania has laid out this thing she calls the American Bioterrorism Program about this whole operation from the U.S. standpoint and how the laws have been put in place. And she starts out by saying it's been going on for centuries. And at first I thought I misunderstood her, like, no, she means decades, right? No.
No, she's right.
Yeah, yeah. And there you go with the history. Right. I think that's fascinating the way you tie it in.
It's very important to understand that. Otherwise, you get all hung up on Obama, like, well, if we just get rid of Obama, it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Let's just get rid of one poison apple. There's bushels of those guys.
Exactly.
He'll be replaced. He's nothing. If he literally drowned with Michael tomorrow, or whatever that thing he married with, nobody will miss him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They'll be gone.
He's a red herring. I totally agree with you now. I see that. And people like him, Fauci, an individual bad apples are red herrings. So that you, yeah. So
if we just get rid of Fauci, you know,
right.
And likewise, the savior syndrome. Oh, we need someone, a white knight, you know, Trump to come in and save the world. You know, it's like Trump's not going to save the world. Yeah, it's extreme. The only people that's going to save the United States are Americans like us. Trump's not going to save it. Yeah. Biden's not going to destroy it, but he's certainly helping. Of course, he's just a meat puppet. Keep in mind, it's far easier to destroy than it is to create.
Mm.
It's far easier to be an arsonist than it is to be an architect, right?
Right.
Look at Al-Qaeda again. When we would see Al-Qaeda come into towns like Bakuba in Iraq, and they come in and they take the thing over, and those clowns can't run a water plant. They want water too, but everybody left, and they don't know how to do it. What do you think these Haitians can run our nuclear plants? They can't even pump up the air in their bicycles.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I mean,
seriously.
Right.
You know, Haitians, something about Haitians, their IQ is just not there. It's not as high. You go to Dominican Republic and people are a lot smarter. And that's on the same island.
Hmm.
I've talked with people about this quite a lot. Why are Haitians, not all of them, some of them are quite intelligent, actually. But it could be just some wild theory. I don't know if it's true. It could be based on parasites. I don't know. I'm not a biologist. I'm not a doctor, but I mean, you are. Maybe you could have a theory there. But I've seen this around the world some places. You know, let me give you an example, not to compare people with dogs, but let's do it. Like, I spent years in Thailand. Those dogs are smart. They're super smart. They're smarter than your average American dog by far. You know what I mean? They're like low-level monkey smart, right?
Wow.
And like the average Thai dog is just, I'm not talking poodles and stuff. I'm talking about their soy ma. Soy ma means street dog, right? But then we went to Belize. We were there with Operation Burning Edge. Misako Ganaha was there, and Vandersteel and I and some others were there.
Mm-hmm.
And the dogs in Belize were the dumbest dogs I ever saw. I messaged to my sister, she's a veterinarian. I said, why are these dogs so dumb? They just stand in the middle of the road, cars zipping all around them. I mean, busy roads, not like the back roads that they do in North Carolina. You go to North Carolina up in, you know, Andrews or Murphy or something, the dogs will sleep in the middle of the streets like they do in Asia, right? But I'm talking about on the busy roads, you know, they just have no sense to get out of the way.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I see this around them. I see it even in monkeys. In different parts of the world, I see, hey, the same sort of monkey in this part of India is clearly more aggressive or smarter as a group
yeah.
than the same sort of monkeys in a different part of India. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I wonder if there's something like parasitic in them or something, but there is some problem. Look at what they've done to Haiti.
But
and you draw a line.
Yeah.
Dominican Republic, same island, and it's like people go on vacation there.
But with that proximity, that's what I was thinking in the show. I had asked you something to the effect about, well, why hasn't the culture bled from one side or the other? You know, if it's parasites, which I think is a great speculation, it's a great possibility, because there's a lot of mental changes and damage. But why hasn't that spread? There's a natural tendency, you know, for organisms, parasites, bad behavior. I mean, why doesn't it spread?
That's one thing that we've talked about as well, because I'm not a doctor, but I do know a few things, like, you know, cholera goes down the river and gets the guys down the river too, and it might even get them worse, because you know how cholera is.
What did your sister think, the veterinarian? What would did she have any
she didn't know. She's like, you know, she said the same thing you, like, it's, you know, it's interesting speculation, but she didn't know either. But you know, one thing I've learned though is everything you touch touches you, right? Whether and that deals with information as well as religions. If one religion is in the same neighborhood as another, over time they will begin to syncretize, right?
Right.
To form a syncretism, right? So everything you touch touches you, and again, and that includes our communication. Some of what I'm saying will go into you, and some of what you're saying will come into me, and then out, and it spreads. It spreads like a literal virus, right?
Yeah.
It's very interesting how, you know, I used to think when I was a kid, I wanted to become a physicist. So I was like addicted to physics for like a decade, right? Mm. I was like failing my school classes and stuff because I just wanted to study physics. But because I thought physics is where I could find truth, right? I was like, at first I was interested in chemistry. I'm like, nah, that's just like, that's cool, but it's really cool. But I'm more interested in physics because I thought, you know, if I understand these things and I can,
right, there are
I'm no
laws.
Closer to the truth than I ever was.
Right.
But as I've gotten older and learned more, there's a higher learning, and I think it deals with information, right? And anyway, that's a whole separate
subject.
Yeah,
and what you do with that information, and I don't want to over tie it back, but when you talk about like the possibility of a theory of, you know, parasites or some illness that doesn't affect, it's because it will, you know, it will affect the frontal cortex where we have executive, you know, function, planning and discerning, and how that can be different from person to person. But anyway, I mean, we're
can going... I say one more thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Love this discussion.
Books like the Bible, you know, books like the Bible, which has existed for so long.
Yeah.
And there must have been billions and billions and billions of copies, you know, it would not have survived if it weren't something of a survival manual, right? Mm. I mean, if you follow these general rules, you're probably more likely to get through the rough waters, you know?
Good point.
I mean, our ancestors were super smart. Like, I was doing this interview about 3 years ago, and I've read more than five dozen books on pandemic and about two dozen on famine. I read a lot, you know, as you can see. I mean, it's unbelievable how much time I've been able to read.
It is.
Like, I loved the pandemic this time because I just read for like 7 months straight. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
So, but I got kicked out of Hong Kong and I just read books for 7 months. Right. But the bottom line is I noticed that pandemic, famine, and war go together, mm-hmm. right? Because I've read between pandemic and famine a good more than 80 books, right? And you'll see, pandemic, okay, here comes the famine. And the books, here comes the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Like, you always get tight in famines, you always see typhus, right?
Yeah.
You'll always see, epidemic typhus, you and I talked about recently. And that's why they call it famine fever. And they also call it war fever.
Yes, there are certain illnesses that emanate from famine, right? And you're not ruling out that this famine, war, pandemic is contrived. Or, you know, like, you just got...
Oh, this one clearly is this time.
It's okay.
Like, you can start... Not all fires are natural from lightning.
No.
You know what I mean? And so, interestingly, I was doing this interview maybe 3 years ago, and one of my readers was on there, and I was talking about Panfor as if I wisely had found it. So I call it PANF War, pandemic, famine, war. I think I started calling that in maybe January or February or something
Pan
of
fam war.
2020, PANF War, so that people could remember it, like PANF War, pandemic, famine, war. And she goes, you know, I've been reading your work for a long time, and I would like to say something about the PANF War that, you know, she said, actually, it's in the Bible, the Four Horsemen. And I was like, oh, man, you're right. I probably plagiarized the Bible. It's like, you know, source amnesia. Didn't realize where I had originally learned it from.
Right.
But as I'm, you know what I mean? Like,
it was in there.
Source amnesia. We all have source amnesia a lot, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that was kind of embarrassing. I clearly, almost certainly plagiarized the Bible. But I mean, but the thing is
it's
they
a good
knew
thing.
It way back then. They knew it well enough to write it down to warn about it, right?
Yeah.
And so if you look up, like, you look up cannibalism in the Bible, you look up famine, and you'll see some, they talk about it a lot, right? And what I'm getting to is there's wisdom in there that can be gleaned. You know what gleaning is? Gleaning from the Bible?
Taking it in.
Glean and take like gleaning from farmers is the farm, you know, gleaning means leaving some of your produce in the farm so that passersby and indigent people can feed. I was talking with this farmer about a year and a half ago in Netherlands. His name is Jordan. He's the farmer I took Jordan Peterson to see, actually. He's one of those giant Dutch farmers. He's a dairy farmer, which is probably why he's so giant. Does milk make you tall? Anyway, but
I'll drink more if it does.
He's funny. This guy's funny, man. I have to, like, Jordan, bend down and talk with me, man. Seriously. Michael. And so we were talking about gleaning, and he said, so this is like a year and a half ago. He said, you know what? My grandparents used to talk about that from World War II, and my parents would talk about it. And he said, just last week, so this would be about a year and a half ago or so, I saw down the road, people were gleaning on my neighbor's farm. And he said, we haven't seen that in our lifetime. He said, because the prices are so high in Netherlands now, people are starting to glean, right? And if you look on YouTube, you can see videos on how to glean. But gleaning is when also this when the people were flooding into Europe in 2016, I was publishing, you can find it online. I was like, they're going to steal from your farms, because in the countries I live in and spend so much time in, I mean, there's people macheted to death stealing people's apricots and stuff.
My
you know what
God.
I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, oh, they'll be out there on a full moon waiting with their machete because they know that's when you're going to steal, is when the moon is right. So, I mean, what I'm getting to is this is one of the things, one of the ways that famines actually grow as well is, again, when people start stealing from the farmers. By the way, one of the things I've noticed in famines is the governments always blame the farmers. I've never seen an exception to that. They always, like, it's the farmers' fault. And they start blaming the wholesalers and the retailers. The reason the prices are high is because you're making a profit, a huge profit. Right. And I saw Trudeau doing that, you know, about the food. He's like, we're going to do food. And then the government always does price caps, which always backfire. I'm using the word always a lot.
Sure.
But I'm telling you, in every book I've read on famine, a couple of dozen, they always blame the farmers in all of those books. And then the government gets involved and makes it worse. And each
looks like you've been sleeping well.
Megan, he's back. The My Pillow guy.
And you're looking good.
Still feeling good.
Well, just when you thought it couldn't get any better, we've got the best pillow ever. My Pillow 2.0. When I invented MyPillow, it had everything you'd ever want in a pillow. Well, now there's new technology that makes it even better. MyPillow 2.0 has my patented fill combined with a cooling fabric with temperature regulating thread. MyPillow 2.0 is truly the next generation of MyPillow.
Now's the time to go to MyPillow.com or call the number on your screen. Use the promo code to save 50% on your MyPillow 2.0.
You're sleeping even better.
And cooler, too.
And you're looking good.
Feeling good.
I knew you would.
MyPillow.com.
Hi, everyone. Dr. Jane Ruby here with a quick message on how you should be protecting your retirement funds, your 401k, your IRAs. Did you know that you can protect them with physical gold and silver to avoid losing everything that you've built over your lifetime? Please call the experts at Augusta Precious Metals at 888-836-1890. At least talk to an expert, learn more about how you can protect what you've built up so that if things go crazy, as we know they will in this economy, you've got some of your investments protected with tangible physical gold and silver. Every bit as valuable as real estate, something you can touch, they can't turn off, you know, with a flick of a switch. Call the people at Augusta Precious Metals. They're wonderful. They will educate you on what this is all about and what you need to do. And they will also provide you with some warnings about how to protect yourself from other companies that may be spreading lies and scamming you. That's Augusta Precious Metals at 888-836-1890.
Worse. In each, every case, they've made it worse. You know, they think that they can, well, we're the government. We're smarter than all you clowns. And they make it worse.
Right.
You know, and the governments don't tend to survive famines, by the way. Go ahead.
Really?
I'm sorry.
That's interesting.
No governments. So if you want to get rid of the United States government, if you want to get rid of all the German, the German government, all the rest,
let the famine happen.
Famine. That's another, you see they're creating conditions for famine, right? This will be a surefire way to get rid of the system of government.
Is that because the people, you know, when you get down to food, surviving or not, that's a daily, is that because the people finally step up and go, whoa, you know, this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It comes to Maslow's hierarchy, you know what I mean? And so, for instance, you know, the KGB was actually formed out of Stalin trying to find where the kulaks, you know, in Ukraine were hiding food, right?
Right.
And so, you would get part of the food if you could tell rat on your neighbor and that sort of thing. Death penalty in China during Mao fashioned his famines after Stalin because he kind of followed Stalin, right, in his footsteps. Not kind of, I mean, he definitely did a lot of that. But there was a death penalty for coming out at night in both of those places. But it didn't matter. Nobody cares about a death penalty when you're starving to
death. Sure.
You're right.
So, yep.
And you know, one thing that's interesting in famines, I've noticed in so many of these books, is that there's a lot of fires in famines.
Mm.
And mysteriously, several of the books actually talked about that. I think in Mao's Great Famine and Red Famine, I think both of those books may have talked about it. And several other books, one about the Irish famine, so many fires. And there seems to be some specific reasons for it. One is people just aren't paying attention anymore. And another is, though, if you're in charge of the warehouse and you've been stealing from it the whole time, because, you know, that food is suddenly worth gold, you know, and so your family's going to eat. But also now, you know, to cover up your crimes, you burn it, right?
Ooh.
And you just, you know, and so a lot of, you know, so that is one theory that seems to hold water in some circumstances. But there's a lot of fires that don't seem to be related to that. And some theories are just like, well, there's just, you know, during time of famine, people just don't. They're not in their right mind, you know? And you know something about pandemic as well. Rich people die first. You know, every time I say that to rich people, I just watch their face. And
why is that?
I'm about to tell them how rich people die first. And they always like, really? I'm like, yeah. And I'll tell you why.
Now they're interested.
You got the jab, didn't you? I know you didn't, but you got the jab, didn't you? And you were probably bragging to your friends about how you skipped the line and went first. Mm. That's how you die. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of virologists and immunologists and vaccinologists and all those guys out there, but very few of them study pandemic. Pandemic is its own thing,
well,
right? Like you and I talked about privately.
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, maybe this is something that's happening to the royal family. You know, we got Kate Middleton, who's been absent for 3 months. Charles has some kind of cancer. I mean, how could they be stupid enough to take it? And why?
Look at the crown prince in Thailand.
Yeah.
You know, she got four jabs, right? Two AstraZeneca and two Moderna. But the bottom line, and look, she's now a vegetable, right?
Oh.
And, you know, I hope she comes out of it, but, you know, I know one of her doctors and he says it's not happening.
Do rich people die first because they think they're getting the best of everything first? I mean, yeah, I want that shot. I don't care. You know, I'm getting in the front of the line. Is it that kind of thing? Why isn't some intelligence source telling them, hey, don't take it. It's part of a global, you know, don't take it. That's not for you.
Oh, the rich people are being targeted as well, right? This is oligarch versus oligarch. And, you know, Masako Ganaha and Chuck Holton and I, we were down in Panama We had met this family, a Haitian family, actually. Actually, we liked this family quite a lot. We met them in Colombia.
Yeah.
And one was a 16-year-old girl named Medese, and her younger brother, he was 12, I think, or 11. Michael was his name, and their mother. So we met them in Colombia. They were getting ready to go through the Darien. We kept in contact, and they made it to Mexico. So we flew up to Mexico to see them, right? And we spent a couple of days with them. And Medese was, I told her, I was like, you know, she said to me, she goes, when I grow up, I want to be a pediatrician or a flight attendant. I said, pediatrician, do it. Become a pediatrician. And because she, and I said, you know, we'll send you medical books, right? So she ended up in New Jersey, and she's putting on her Facebook, she wants to go back to Haiti. I mean, this girl was very smart.
Really?
And so like, so upbeat. I was like, you know what? You could write, self-help books, and people would love you because you're just always like, yeah, we were in the jungle and there was terrible this and terrible that, but we're okay because with God's will, we're going to make it. Like every 5 minutes, she'd say, with God's will, we did it. With God's will, we'll continue. Anyway, but the bottom line is, so when we were flying from Panama, up to Mexico in Tapachula, where they had then made it there. Her family had made it there. So I was with Misako and Ganaha and Chuck Holton. And on the flight beside me is Misako and then this Brazilian girl in her young 20s or so and her brother, right? Very pretty girl. We're talking, her English is perfect. And she's like, she's going to the United States. And so, and I said, why are you going to the United States? And she said, because I'm getting the vaccine. Oh. And because she's just going up for the weekend to get the vaccine.
Oh, very, no.
Yeah. Because, and I said, you're obviously from a very wealthy family. And she's like, well, I'm, you know, we're lucky. And I said, you're very lucky. And let me tell you what.
Let me tell you why.
And I'm like, I know you're probably not going to believe me because I'm some random American you met on this airplane.
Yeah.
But maybe you'll just hesitate a bit. People like you who can afford to do these things are the ones who tend to die
first
or be damaged the most.
Wow.
Because you're the one. I gave her some examples of books to read, like The Remedy. It's about tuberculosis. Robert Koch versus Pasteur. Read that one. Or just read over and over and over. And you'll see all these wealthy people getting to the head of the line and falling over dead, right? And being very seriously injured, right? And we kept in contact for a while, and because I kept messaging her, please don't take it, but I think she did actually, and her brother as well.
No.
So I hope they're well. But the thing is, but that's how the rich people die first. If you've got gold. Somebody will definitely want to separate you from it, and they'll tend to want to cut the line. You know what I mean? Like, look, I've got the best doctor in the world. I mean, how many rich people do you know that have the best doctor in the world? I'm like, you can't all have. I'm like, do you all have the same doctor? It's like, he told you to take the jab, he's not the best doctor in the world.
You
or
bet.
She's not, right?
You bet. Do you believe? I mean, do you think that maybe we don't hear more about like Hollywood, because they're super wealthy, dying from the shots, because it's kind of kept, you know, it's kept down, it's hidden, you know. What do you think about? Because I would have expected more. I know why Congress, they're not dropping dead, because they exempted themselves, but what about Hollywood?
How many from Hollywood have? I mean, I don't, you know, as you
that's
can imagine,
true.
I don't
watch a lot of young deaths. Yes.
Yeah. But there have been a lot of strange things happening. I like way above what I would call the noise line. I mean, they're above the noise floor here. You know, I mean, there's a lot of strange happenings with people dropping dead and getting very ill right after they take the jab and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Michael, before we let you go, because, you know, you have some wonderful stories. I know that about you personally, but this has been so special. I just want to give you the last word. Is there anything you want to say to the American people and beyond? Because there are a lot of people out of the U.S. that in Europe as well that watch the show. Any last parting words? And we're going to, of course, have Operation Burning Edge that you and Ann Vandersteel put together with the rest of your team, and we'll put up where they can find the work. But any last words? What do you want people to know based on your work?
All of us have families that have been through pandemic, famine, and war. All of us. We all have long family lines, you know. Some people think they're the only ones with veterans in their family, but I assure you, everybody has them, you know, and everybody has veterans, war veterans, and pandemic and famine veterans. And so, but we're still here. But a lot of people aren't and would have been if they had. One thing I found about famine, there's always people who see it coming first. Mm. Like if you actually look at the screensaver on my phone, it's a guy named Kenjiro from Japan. All the Japanese know who Kenjiro is, right? There's statues of him in all the Japanese schools, Kenjiro, right? Kenjiro noticed that he thought some famine was coming because he saw certain signs, like eggplant in the summer tasted like eggplant normally tastes in the fall. And leaves were falling off the tree early that year. Just things like that. Mm-hmm. And he's like, hey, we could have a problem with the weather this year. And so he started trying to encourage people, or not trying, but he was successful, encouraging a lot of people to grow more millet, less rice, grow things that grow underground, that sort of thing.
I see.
And so, yeah, so the people in his area, nobody died of famine, but a lot of others did. So he became known for that. He's not the only one in Japan. Misako and I, we went to northern Japan last year. We went to this town. I forgot the name of it, but we went to that town because there had been huge famine there. They have famine menus, actually, the famine menu and that sort of thing. And their sort of lord at that time also saw it coming, and he was able to avert it. Not for everybody. I think about 1 million people died in that famine, but nobody in his area, because he had gotten them prepared, make fish ponds, right? Grow, I think, garlic next to the fish. There was just a lot of different things. Like there was a lot of some wisdom, and a lot of this is written down. It's in Japanese. Some of it's translated to English, and you Kenjiro. Can find it online. And you know, Kenjiro, K-E-N-J-I-R-O. Kenjiro.
Oh, Kenjiro. Kenjiro.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so he's a brilliant guy. We went to a couple museums for him and that sort of thing. And so, interesting. So then other people wanted him to come around and spread his wisdom to other communities as time went on, and would pay him to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was just a smart guy. But it was, in addition to being smart, and he also had the courage to, like, be the only one that sees it for now, and he would persuade others, right? And then so he was persuasive and persistent, and it worked, and he saved a lot of people's lives. Mm. You know, in Thailand, King Rama the Ninth, he was a good king. He was the father of the current king. And King Rama the Ninth in the 1960s, he had a protein problem, right? There was not enough protein in Thailand, right? And so so he's like, what are we going to do? He's a smart guy. He saw it coming, and he studied water and that sort of agriculture. When I go to Thailand, I've been all over that country, man. I've been like remote villages, and there'll be like a photo of the king of Thailand in some super remote village. There's no road to it. And he's clearly at that village next to the waterfall that's right there, right? And I'm like, how did he get to every corner, little postage stamp of Thailand? He knew his country, right? Mm. In detail. In texture, right? Mm-hmm. All these different ethnic groups, they all loved him because he would come see them and like, hey, what's your problem? Hey, where are you growing opium? It's not Thai to grow opium. We need to grow flowers and stuff. So he'd send experts out. He got them to stop growing opium, you know, and if you keep growing opium, we'll send the army. So he did, you know, but so he did the, so he basically using a lot of just good sense, he got them. Anyway, so in the 60s, he saw this famine, protein issues. So he's like, what do I do? He gets all of his team together, and he's like, he called his friend in Japan, Crown Prince Akihito, right? And he said, we got a protein problem. So Crown Prince said, oh, we've had a lot of famines. Like Misako was going through old Japanese archives. Mm-hmm. She found a reference to like 503 famines, I think it was, in 1500 years. Not all of Japan, just islands here and there and parts of Japan.
But that's a lot.
I mean, they had that. So, but Japanese know how to deal with famines. Some of them do. And what they would, one of the things that they do is they build fish ponds, right? So Crown Prince Akihito, he told, you fly over Thailand now, it looks like the moon, all these craters for fish ponds. You know what I mean? You go to villages. So Crown Prince Akihito said, I'll send you these Nile perch, basically. They're called tilapia, right?
Tilapia.
And so he sent like 50 or something tilapia to the king of Thailand, who then started growing the tilapia, right? And so, and they had fish ponds all over Thailand, and they never, so, and that was the famine you never heard about because he saw it coming and he prepared for it. So they took that Japanese, they took the crown prince's wisdom and took the fish, started growing them in mass, told everybody dig fish ponds, and they were throwing them all over the place. Those things are everywhere now. So if you go to Thailand, or maybe somebody's watching this from Thailand, and you go to the menu and you look up pranil, pranil. So pra is P-H-R-A, that means fish in Thai. Nil, N-I-L, Nile, that means fish from the Nile, pranil, fish Nile, right? So if you see it on the menu, pranil, some of the Thais actually know that is from the, you know, the original crown prince's eye. It's wisdom from Japan that flowed through the, you know, it's that wisdom that flowed through him, came to Thailand. Now you'll see, you look on YouTube about how to build fish ponds, you'll see Filipinos going, here's a better way to build fish ponds and stuff. They're very resilient. They got fish ponds everywhere, right? So there's many ways that you can increase your resilience depending on your circumstance. One of those is fish ponds, you know?
Yes.
And,
you know, Michael, from your 30,000 foot view or whatever, 50,000, it just struck me. Sometimes the threat of a famine or the famine's coming, and luckily he saw it, and is actually kind of like a thunderstorm in the life of humanity, because it gets people, it freshens up their will to live and their innovation with regard to creating a solution. You know, either when the problem hits or before the problem hits. I know I'm going a little bit off on a tangent, but you just struck that thought in me that sometimes these things, if you're really looking at it overall, are not things to be afraid of. They're things to be aware of, to work with your fellow man, create solutions. He reached out to his friend in Japan. I mean, there's so many lessons here. You know, I just want to highlight that out, and thank you. Thank you.
Don't hesitate to ask others for advice. Like, hey, it's these fish. Once you throw these out, they're going to be like tribbles. They're going to be everywhere. You know?
Yeah. That's a great story. That's a great story. Michael, I'm so honored to know you and on every level. And thank you so much for being, doing the show and sharing so much of these great stories. I'm gonna put the squeeze on you to come back if you don't mind, because it's so wonderful and fascinating. So I know you'll do it from a jungle. You'll do it from a jungle.
I'll be in Japan soon.
Okay. We'll give our best to Masako Ganaha. She's beautiful. And you guys are great. Great team. Yeah. Great team.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a great night. Michael, thank you so much for being here. And thanks to everybody.
Thank you, Doctor.
You bet, for staying for After Talk, an exclusive of the Dr. Jane Ruby Show. And don't forget to check out the main show with Michael Yan that ran Friday night. So have a great night, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow morning for Coffee Chat. Medical disclaimer. The Dr. Jane Ruby Show does not provide medical advice. The information, including but not limited to texts, graphics, images, and other material contained on this show, are for informational purposes only and does not establish any kind of patient-client relationship by your viewing or attempt to communicate with Dr. Jane Ruby. No material presented on the show is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health care provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment before undertaking a new health care regimen. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have seen on the show. Thank you for watching.